books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show, recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host Robert Kirkwood, and today we present a talk from wildlife cameraman Gordon Buchanan, live on stage at the Boswell Book Festival. The talk was sponsored by RNIB Connect Radio, and Gordon Buchanan is in conversation with Robert Dawson Scott.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Robert Dawson Scott. It's my very great pleasure to welcome you to the 2026 Boswell Book Festival and to this afternoon's session with, I think, possibly the Isle of Mull's most famous wildlife cameraman.
One of them.
Mr. Gordon Buchanan, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Now, care to tell us where you were last night, Gordon?
Well, if you're at a birthday party, there should be ice cream, there should be jelly, and if there's not, there should at least be a cake. So is that David Attenborough?
Yeah.
100 years old, they didn't even get him a cake.
Oh, so, that's a shame.
It was at Albert Hall, wasn't it?
Yeah. I bet it was a great occasion.
It was funny because he didn't want to do anything. I suppose when you get to that age, you've had quite a few birthdays, and he was like, "I would just be at home with a glass of red wine," and he didn't want to do so. But I think obviously the nation and the wildlife community said, "Well, we're going to be doing something." So it was kind of hastily put together, but it was just a real, a truly monumental evening, and it was, you know, to celebrate somebody that, you know, has had an sort of indescribable impact on so many people. You know, I said last night, you know, reaching the age of 100 is one of his minor achievements. I think it's just the influences he's had, you know, across the world. And, you know, no one has observed the natural world in the history of humanity, in the history of this planet. No one has sort of been the narrator of nature in the way that he has. There's no one that comes anywhere near, will ever come near.
You saw when you were a kid, you were watching those kind of things on your black and white telly and wherever.
Yeah, he's obviously such a charismatic person that with Life on Earth was probably the first time that I saw him in action. And I just, you know, to see him sitting beside mountain gorillas or beside albatross, I just thought because he looked part of that, you know, he was like accepted by all these different animals. And I sort of thought, oh God, this is way before I had, you know, any inkling that I was going to end up in a sort of, or as he would say, in the same vineyard. That's what he said. He said to the first time, he goes, "We labour in the same vineyard."
Toiling in the same vineyard.
Yeah. Yes. And so before I knew that we were going to toil in the same vineyard, I just thought, what an extraordinary job to be so close to animals and to be so.
That's actually a good description of you, being at ease in these extraordinary places with these extraordinary creatures. That's something I don't know what it's really like, but it's something that you demonstrate extremely effectively, it seems to me. You do seem to have all sorts of natural empathies, rapports, I don't know.
I kind of put that down to, maybe kind of being hyper-aware is quite good, and I think as a child I was quite hyper-aware of people's emotions.
Right.
But I worked with horses from about the age of 10 until I was 15, 16. I worked with horses, and they teach you a lot about sensitivity around animals. Because with horses, you can only really get the best with, I wouldn't even say from them, you can only do the best things with a horse if you connect with them. So I think that was a really good training ground to spend, you know, 5 of my formative years with one of the most sensitive creatures on earth, and that's sort of, you know, I've taken, I suppose, what I've learned, you know, about horses to, you know, gorillas and elephants. You always just sort of they're who is important. You have to read their behavior, and you're not really there as an observer as such. You're there to make a connection and sort of try and I suppose be the conduit for that experience to an audience.
And on a slightly less happy note, we'll get to the book in just a moment. The other figure in the natural wildlife filmmaking world, Doug Allen, who died sadly just about a month ago in Nepal. You knew him as well, I think.
Yeah, funny enough, when I was 17 and before I kind of even did my first job, I saw Doug speak, and he was sort of, you know, one of the most accomplished underwater wildlife filmmakers. He was from Fife, from a sort of...
It sounds like that makes him good at being underwater.
But just, he kind of worked, sort of working class, sort of, he kind of fell into the wildlife film industry, and when I saw him talk sort of back in 1989, I mean, he's a tiny wee guy.
Is that right?
Yeah, he's really small, but he was a huge presence, and I thought at the age of 17, I want to be that guy.
Right.
That's even sort of, having watched David Attenborough programmes, I was like, actually, that's the guy that I want to be.
And that's partly because he did come from Dunfermline and he was just a regular guy.
Yeah, just a regular sort of regular guy that sort of found his way into this extraordinary... And, you know, having, you know, done some really dodgy stuff across his life and dived under the ice with it. Just recently, we were chatting about Doug after he passed away, and somebody said, yeah, you... We didn't want to use a tether under the ice because you don't want to get that in shot.
Right.
Because that limits, you can't turn back and film the way that you've sort of came through this tiny little ice hole. And so it's fine, it's okay, it's bright, you can find your way, you can find your way back. But yeah, quite a fearless character.
So. But anyway, we must talk about your book. Here is the book, In the Hide, the subtitle, How the Natural World Saved My Life. And it's not exactly an autobiography, I wouldn't say. It's much more of a sort of, you dip in and out of the film work on the one hand and your personal life on the other, almost like a kind of mosaic.
Mm.
But what made you kind of put down the camera and pick up the pen, metaphorically speaking?
Peer pressure, I suppose. I think, and a fate... A fading memory. I think there's a lot of things, experiences that I've had, and that it's sort of, they're getting a little bit hazy. And I've always sort of thought I should really kind of write these things down. I used to keep diaries.
Yeah.
When I was 17, 18, 19, kept diaries when I first started traveling. But then I think when devices came along, that was sort of, you know, that kind of keeping a diary, you know, went out the window because there's other things you could do in the evening.
Yeah.
But I think that maybe the thing that held me back was that I don't take the natural world for granted, but I have from the age of 17, I think from the age of, you know, 7 when we moved to the Isle of Mull, I've had a very privileged relationship with the natural world. You know, I just loved growing up on Mull and having that freedom. And I think struggling at school and not liking being indoors was something that was sort of, you know, just made me feel so at home in the great outdoors. And I think, you know, and I was never really doing, you know, what I do to impress anyone. It was just sort of wildlife filmmaking gave me this opportunity to have these adventures. So I think I kind of thought, oh, who's interested in any of this stuff? And then I suppose over, you know, you think, okay, there's a few good anecdotes in there. And I suppose I have had quite a kind of interesting path into the wildlife filmmaking industry.
Sure. Well, we'll talk about that. And we will get to the polar bear, don't worry, in due course. But in many ways, that, as you say, you grew up in Alexandria, just back of Dumbarton there, and then you moved to Mull. And in many ways, it sounds like a kind of almost Swallows and Amazons meets Gerald Durrell's My Family and Other Animals meets The Wasp Factory. I don't know. An idyllic childhood to begin with, in many ways.
Yeah, I think it's funny because, you know, Tobermory, that's my hometown, you know, is famously one of the most colourful towns in the world, especially when the sun's shining, if it shines. But, you know, to go from a housing estate in Dumbarton, which is really kind of all I could really remember about my life. And so we lived in a sort of very grey... At the time, I didn't think it was, you know, it's just where we lived. But looking back on it, it was pretty ropey.
I think West Dumbartonshire is still one of the
poorest. Yeah, but they've levelled, it was Bellesmire that we lived in, and they've levelled all of that now, so it's still quite nice. But the school was still in existence, maybe up until sort of maybe 10 years ago, and I took our daughter drive past sort of a trip. I said, I think I put this in the book, I said, oh, we're going to go for a trip down memory lane. And she said, oh, I've always wanted to go down memory lane, as if it was a place. I said, well, this is Bellesmire, it's not, it's not what you think it's going to be. And half the houses were still there, and I was like, God, this is grim. And I mean, for my mum, I think, you know, having four kids on her own, living in a place that sort of, you know, was pretty, you know, lots of kind of building social problems. But the primary school was there, and Lola, I said, and that was my first school. And she said, when did that close down? I said, it's still open.
By the way, it looks like, yeah.
But going to Mull was sort of like in The Wizard of Oz, when it goes from black and white, from Kansas to Oz, and it just, lovely, yeah. Everything springs into colour. That's sort of kind of what it, you know, what it felt like, you know, if there was a monochrome existence in a kind of urban, you know, setting, to sort of, you know, the freedom and the colour and the greenery of the West Coast.
It must have been a great relief. I mean, as you said, your mum was on your own by this stage because your father had disappeared. I can't quite remember. You do say what had happened. So for a while, it was your siblings and your mum. Mm-hmm. And that was all good, really. I mean, you didn't have much money, but by and large, it sounds as if you were having a great time. You made friends. You were, you know, out in a boat. You had an island of your own, almost, as it were. It sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
Until it all went wrong, as it were.
Well, I think it's sort of, it's easy, you know, somewhere like Mull, if you like the outdoors, and I was never aware of that, I think my mum, had she not been as busy, you know, putting food on the table, she would have seen that, is that, how come, you know, you've got this son that's not a complete dum-dum, why is he not doing well at school? And I just, I really struggle at school, and I'm sure I'm
dyslexic.
But I think sort of, you know, that I'm so grateful for. I think had I done better at school, I would have had more options. And so I think I probably would have gone through my sort of high school thinking, oh, well, I'll go to college or go to university, whereas that was never going to be an option for me. But then, yeah, sort of quite early on, my mum sort of met a local fisherman, and they started this relationship, and quite quickly, you know, they said they're going to get married. And I remember, this must have been maybe 8 or 9, and at that age, when my mum told us this, I thought, this is not going to end well. I just knew there was something off about him. It had a lot of superficial charm, and a kind of very charismatic person, but with some real fundamental problems and issues. And it was domestic abuse that sort of started off, you know,
quite low level.
Low level, but then sort of built over a period of years to sort of, this is, he could kill her. This is. I have to say,
ladies and gentlemen, the book is fantastically straight from the shoulder. I mean, nothing is spared here. It's quite a tough read. So God knows what it must be like to live all that. And it got really extreme.
Yeah, it's funny because when we were actually in the green room, somebody said, "Oh, well, you can have that, you're writing about wildlife. It's not a particularly contentious sort of book that you've written." I said, "Well, if you're in my family, it was quite contentious, because I think, you know, you've got to obviously run this stuff by family members to make sure that, you know, they're happy
with you.
And I think for my mum,
she's still very much with us.
Yeah, and she knew that as part of my story. It's insane. I think once you kind of you are witness to domestic abuse, and it becomes normalized, so you don't expect sort of things to be any different. That is normal for you. You live under the threat of some bad things happening. And my sister, who's 3 years younger than me, she knew nothing of what was happening all through her childhood. So until they sort of, it wasn't too much later. But she knows, you know, she's completely aware of everything that went on. And she even said, when I was writing the book, it's not as if, you know, it's like, you know, you were living with this monster, sort of, you know, terrified of him and sort of in fear of your life, and that he had a huge impact on the person that you are. And I'm like,
Yeah, he kind of did. what you say.
But yeah, but the strange thing is that it wasn't ever discussed in the family. And I think that's sort of, you know, that it's really detrimental to kind of, you know, to people to witness things that, you know, bad things, and for them not to be discussed. I think that was just my mum's way of handling it. Because there's obviously this sort of shame that comes from that, that, you know, you wish it wasn't happening, so that her way of dealing with it was just, you know, we never talked about it until we're all kind of
shame
grown up.
The shame of being a victim is a very tricky one, but very widespread.
Yeah. But the interesting thing was, it was like she was happy for me to talk. I sent her sort of a paragraph, the kind of, I suppose, the hardest bit to write and the hardest bit I thought for her to read. And she said, that's fine. But then about a sort of week later, and we weren't poor, you know. She was sort of more concerned.
Fabulous.
About us being poor. And I said, I don't say that we're poor, but we, you know, we lived in a caravan for 2 years. And many people on Mull lived in caravans back then. But, you know, as a mum of 4 kids living in a caravan on her own, she had 3 jobs. You know, there was sort of things that we didn't have. You know, we kind of sort of, you know, didn't have a car and didn't have a phone in our house until we were sort of like much older. But my mum was just upset. We were, you know, we weren't poor. And we weren't, I mean, Christmas was, as long as you had a good Christmas and you got everything you wanted, that's what it was. We, you know, my mum would get a credit card, max that out for Christmas, and we'd have all the food and all the sort of gifts that kind of we really wanted. And then she'd just spend the rest of the year paying it off. But we weren't poor.
And for the rest, you had the island of Mull, which, I mean, that's enriching right from the word go, isn't it? And I notice you're still very much, I know you don't live there now, but you're still involved with helping to promote the island, and there's a lovely bit of film of you extolling all the virtues of all the things you can do there. So you're still very much part of it, and it's part of you.
Yeah, definitely. It's funny. I think there's sort of the place that I know best is a place that I still have this sense of seeing it for the first time, and places that I've visited. I mean, Tobermory is a classic example. That's sort of, there's just, I think it's because we went there on holiday. I think before my mum and dad split up, and family holidays that I probably don't remember, but that was a place to go on holiday, and here we were in 1979, moving to holiday. We were sort of, so I think there was probably that thing, it was like, I can just be on holiday for sort of the rest of my life, and you know, there's, and to this day, if you were to say where on the planet would you like to explore, there's lots of nooks and crannies and stretches of coastline on Mull that I was like probably there first before I started looking any further afield.
Can I just, before we go any further, can I just ask you about the actual process of writing the book? Because you make it clear that you had you had help, as it were. You won't call him a ghostwriter. In fact, you credit him. Absolutely fair and square, Will Millard on the front cover. How did you do it? You know how you hear about comedy writers who write in pairs, and one of them sits down and writes, the other one paces.
Yeah.
Were you the pacer, or?
Well, I knew that I wanted to write a book, and I knew that I was capable of it, because I think I actually can write quite well when I put my mind to it, but I think this sort of, the dyslexia, I find it really taxing, and it just takes a lot out of me. And then when I sort of, you know, agreed to do the book, and we got a sort of publisher, and they said, would you like some help writing it? And I thought, if it needs to be delivered by July, and it was a really busy year, I said, yes, I will. I'll need help doing that. And Will was just, I actually wanted to work with a woman on it. I just thought that would be a bet. I didn't want a guy to come in thinking, well, I kind of know what you're about, I didn't want it to be written in a masculine kind of anything that kind of hinted towards alpha maleism. So I thought maybe a female voice is kind of was important. But the publisher said, okay, well, we've got three ladies that I'd writers that I'd sort of met, and they said, I've got Will Millard as well. And I said, well, just knock him off the list, because I don't want to do it like with a guy. And I said, well, just, why don't you just meet him? I said, we're wasting his time. And the first person I thought, we found her, she is the perfect person. And then the second one, I was like, oh, actually, no, she's the one. Oh, thank God, okay. So now I know. And the third person, it wasn't really going to work. And then they said, oh, and you've got this call, Zoom call with Will Millard. And I was like, oh, Christ. And then, look, is it? It was either between him and this other person, and I just thought, I kind of thought, I'll read sort of a bit of what they have written, their own work. Right. And Will wrote in the way that I would. He's a lot of similar experiences to me. He's sort of, he was involved in the wildlife film industry.
Oh, okay.
He's been to many of the places, even the kind of most obscure places that I've been to. And there's a real sensitivity to him. And I thought, okay, this is, yeah, maybe, yeah, not maybe, I thought he is the right person. So what he then did was, he was my number one fan. So that was the,
really?
The first meeting after I said, we're going to go with you, he said, well, I have an omission to make, because I am your number one
lovely.
Fan. So he had watched most of, well, not most, he watched every program that I'd ever kind of worked on. He rewatched all of them. He took notes from every word that I'd said. He read every interview, every podcast, everything that I had written, whether it was, you know, obituaries or forewords. And then we sat down and we just spoke, and I told my story, I suppose. Yeah, it's funny because the story started at the beginning, and we got to the end of the first day, and you know, I haven't even left Bellsmire, and he said, "Are you happy for all of this stuff to be in?" And I was like,
"Yeah,
no, this is just context. This isn't content."
And he went, right.
"Yeah, because this is quite hard hitting. This is not what this isn't what I signed up for." But I kind of thought about it. I thought, "No, actually, that is my story," and I didn't want to do. You know, for it to be a romp around the world's wild places and, oh, look at the things that I've done and the things that I've seen. I kind of wanted, I suppose I wanted people to get a sense of, you know, where I'm coming, where I come from and where I'm coming from. And
yeah.
And Will was, it was, yeah, just, it was great. And so I kind of sometimes just joining kind of pieces together. So it's, yeah, it's, and, it's, and I said, this feels like a cop-out because I'm working with a writer. And he said, I'm just, you know, this is your story. These are your words. I'm just the guy putting it all together and putting it in order. And then there was sort of other bits that I really enjoyed of just sitting down and writing. But yeah, it was a good collaborative effort. So I think the term ghost, I don't, because I really more than happy to have sort of Will, you know, sort of celebrated and applauded, because I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have done it on my own.
Like, how long did it take, roughly?
We started in February, and then we kind of did it in different stints. And it was quite hard. It was quite heavy going. I think a lot of the conversations.
I can imagine. Yeah.
So we were doing
stuff
it
to review. Here.
Yeah, and there was a lot of stuff. You know, he'd written, you know, 14,000. No, he wrote 7,000 words, sort of basically, kind of about stuff. You know, me talking about my dad, and I read it, and I thought, that's too much. That's gonna, my dad's still with us, and I just thought, it's all true, but it would destroy him. Right. But he's written 7,000 words. That would take me kind of weeks to get, and he said, it's fine. We just sort of, that's part of the process. You kind of, you tell your story, and then you decide what's in it. So it was,
The thing about avoiding the whole alpha male thing, and I can absolutely see the danger, you know, the big explorer, all this kind of roughy-tufty stuff, but I'm guessing that the awareness of the alpha male thing had something to do with these alpha male figures in your life who'd kind of messed up, as it were.
Mm, yeah.
I mean, is that right?
I would say so. I mean, I'm more suspicious of alpha male types than any other, you know. I think a man with sort of emotion and sensitivity, I feel very comfortable and at home, and because with sort of alpha types, you think, what are they hiding?
Yes.
So I think, you know, growing up on the west coast of Scotland, where, you know, people weren't, you know, men wouldn't express themselves at all. It's so, you know, so repressed, and even men generally wouldn't say that they liked something. They wouldn't even sort of, you know, that was. Yeah, it was just quite good. Everything was just quite good. It's like if you said, "Oh, well, I kind of went to the moon," did a sort of.
Aye, did you?
Like, did you? Quite good. It was quite good. But yeah, it's funny. There's sort of, and there's a podcast series sort of made on Mull, and there's some of the older characters that are being interviewed, and I listened to one recently. I thought, oh God, these poor men have spent their whole life just unable to kind of expose themselves emotionally, which I think would be horrible. So I think that's sort of, you know, growing up in an environment like that, and I think my friends have had a huge influence. We were kind of a set of kids that sort of we've been still friends with the same boys since primary school, and I think we were like a kind of 2.0 Mullochs. We were kind of the update. We were kind of more willing to show kind of like our emotions, like, and actually even physicality. It's funny because when we were like 16, we wouldn't have hugged each other back. That was just, that would have been too far. Yeah. But we used to shake hands. Like whenever we sort of go down, we'll meet at the clock, and we're like, whether it was just at lunchtime or if we're going out in the evening, it's like we'd always shake hands with each other. And like, I remember some of the fishermen's like, these boys always shaking hands. What? Definitely gay. It's funny. There was me and one of my best friends. This is when we were older. I can't remember what it was, but we were both in tears and we were kind of like hugging each other and sort of sobbing. And then there was one of the fishermen was like, "So those two boys hugging and kissing like babies." And I was like, "We weren't kissing. We were just hugging and crying." Yeah, I kind of rebel against all of that. I think it's kind of really dangerous.
And yet, in amongst all this, the extraordinary thing is that, I mean, I made a sort of feeble joke about you being the best wildlife cameraman from Mull, but actually there was another one, Nick Gordon. Yeah. And somehow or other, there was this guy. I mean, what an extraordinary, kind of turn of fate, that there should be this guy and you were able to hang around with him and get to know him and sort of, and then this extraordinary opportunity. When I think you said you'd never been sort of south of Glasgow at this point, and went to Sierra Leone.
I know, we were on a bus. I kind of wish I hadn't gone on this bus trip to Germany, because
a big story.
But if it weren't for the bus trip to Germany, I'd never been abroad. But I'd never been to London, and sort of had the bus trip. We literally drove from Oban to some little town outside Bonn. But I know I didn't have a passport and hadn't been on a kind of sort of package holiday. And when I met Nick, I never imagined that he would have. I just wanted advice, and I thought, and a bit of guidance. And he was the first man that I'd ever met that was actually openly passionate about things. It was enthusiastic and effusive and wasn't ashamed to kind of tell the world the things that, you know, he loved. And I was like, it's so refreshing. Like, my dad wasn't like that. And kind of my stepfather wasn't one like that. And the kind of community sort of, so I just thought he was quite a kind of exotic being. And he offered me the job as his assistant. And I think, for many years, I thought, he had kind of graduates applying for the job. He had people that had sort of lots of experience, that whether they'd gone to sort of study zoology or whether they'd studied photography or a media course. I was 17 and about to leave school with no qualifications. But I think he realised that this was the golden ticket for me. I think he knew that I had no other options, and he'd had sort of three other assistants beforehand that couldn't kind of hack it. They'd sort of jumped ship at some point through the project. So I think he thought, well, this guy, he doesn't have any options. This is the best opportunity he's ever going to get. So I think that's sort of why. And I worked with his wife when I was still at school. Worked with his wife
in
the kitchen.
She ran a restaurant, I think.
And then so I worked in the kitchen with Anne. So he knew through Anne that I kind of was easy to get along with and was a hard worker. He didn't want to be challenged. He didn't want somebody that maybe knew, you know, more than he did. So he thought, okay, if you got this boy knows nothing.
Yeah.
That was sort of the dynamic. And then we became,
And you make it, I mean, so just to quickly, this is an uninhabited island in a river in Sierra Leone to make a film about primates,
yeah.
I think, doesn't it? And you make it pretty clear that it sounds amazing, golden ticket, as you say, what an opportunity, this kid from the islands kind of thing. But, you know, again, you don't pull any punches. You make it clear it was pretty tough.
Yeah, it's
not,
funny.
Not just the Frei Bentos prize.
Yeah, it was, It's funny, I was working with somebody recently who kind of, a guy who kind of, and I spent sort of, ended up spending 6 weeks in the same vehicle as him. But to begin with, he's like, yeah, I was sort of 18. I went off and became a ranger in a national park in Southern Africa and sort of did all this. And I was thinking, God, that's sort of the same age that I went off. And then as we got to know each other, I said, were you actually happy when you were doing that? And he went, no, I was miserable. Me too.
Yeah.
I said, the story was good. And living in a small community, and it was in the open times, a sort of local lad gets kind of Wonka's golden ticket type of thing. And I didn't want to spoil the story for everyone else just sort of say, this is hell. It really was. I remember
for a long time.
Yeah, it was a year and a half. I came home halfway through, but a year and a half. And I was, fantasizing about, we're building these towers. And I thought, if I just, from this height, would it just break an ankle? Or would it be a leg? Because that would get me home. And I was close. And also, funnily enough, I kept a diary every night. And I hadn't opened those diaries because there was a bit of trauma, I think, especially how we left Sierra Leone and what happened in the sort of years after. I didn't ever look back at those diaries. I thought, well, if I'm doing a book, I really should. Mm-hmm. And I thought this book's going to write itself. And it's mostly what I had for dinner, breakfast, and bitching about Nick. That was it. And I thought, God, he was really tough on me. But I think he was sort of, it was early in his career. He was very sort of well-known and accomplished filmmaker, but it was still early in his career. So I think he was one of those, I was getting paid £75 a week and he got more than value for money from me. And it was home, in the days before satellite phones and obviously way before the internet, letter writing was the only way that you could keep in touch. And I'm so glad that I've sort of straddled that analogue and sort of digital world, because I appreciate the fact that, I bought a Starlink last year, so I can be anywhere in the world and I can FaceTime, my family. But back then it was sort of sitting over a little tilly lamp and writing. I wrote to, teachers that I didn't even like, because I thought they'll write back to me. Just, I was craving communication and some connection, and every night I'd write several letters and send them off, and the kind of just the delight at reading and rereading kind of a letter from someone. It was pretty incredible.
And at that point, did you already see yourself as a wildlife cameraman kind of thing and a storyteller, or it seems to me almost this was, as you said, it was just a job that you could get in a way, and you weren't fully aware of the options or the possibilities?
No, I think it wasn't until I met Nick. I was an avid watcher of wildlife documentaries, but I'd never. We're a lot more savvy, how the process of making all sorts of sort of TV, but back then you just saw what was in front of the camera.
Yeah.
And then when I met Nick, I thought, of course, wildlife document. There's men and women out there that are sitting there and they're pressing the button. So I kind of, it was too good an opportunity, and I think it sort of, it was a great place to grow up. But when you get to sort of 15, 16, the west coast of Scotland, particularly those long sort of winter nights, there's not much to do, and sort of just kicking about the streets or going round to friends' houses and sitting drinking cups of tea, and then at the weekends tins of cider and sort of McEwan's Export. But it was I was getting kind of the sort of that world was not quite big enough, as a child looking across the bay. I was like, I didn't need anything, but I think I just knew I had this sort of and also I think kind of having gone through school and feeling sort of feeling of sort of inadequacy and being overlooked and thinking, actually, I'm kind of more clever than sort of you think I am, or not as dumb as you think I am. Yeah. And so I kind of wanted, I felt that I had something to prove to myself, but also to other people.
And so it proved, and then you took a big risk, you borrowed money to buy equipment, and there was a kind of nervy moment there before you got your first kind of commission and all that kind of stuff. And then, but that's as you were just the cameraman, you weren't the on-screen presenter. So that was an important change. And in that sense, you're different from Attenborough, because he wasn't a cameraman. Mm. You are a cameraman, and with all those very, very specialist skills, but you managed to combine that with also the on-screen presentation. How did you... I mean, did somebody suggest it? Do you want to do it?
No, I would call myself a presenter now. A wildlife, I say filmmaker because that covers sort of everything, you know, I would never have used... The word presenter was a dirty word, and I just thought of that. Who would want to be a presenter? And when I sort of... Once my career sort of got on track, I was given a... It was in the Natural World series, and it was an eight-month project to make a film on leopards in Sri Lanka. And I thought, this is a big deal for me, and that's what I'd been aiming for. That was sort of, you know, kind of part of the five-year plan, was to get a Natural World, a film that I could just... That I was the only... I was the, you know, director and cinematographer. And when I got out there, these leopards were really thin in the ground. And I sort of spent 6 weeks, and I said to the producer when I come back, I said, what about we make it about all of the animals in the national park? I said, well, that's not what the BBC have commissioned. He said, but hey, I'll have a chat with the BBC. And he came back to me and he said, there's a big push. So the diversity push back in the mid 90s was not sort of, you know, gender or ethnicity. It was about regional voices. We need sort of less kind of posh English voices on the BBC. So we want, you know, Irish, Welsh, Northern English, Scottish. Yeah. So the editor at the Natural History Unit said, well, he's Scottish. So just, put him in front of the camera. So the producer said to me, they want you to present. And I was like, I don't want to be a presenter. That's a problem. So I kind of did it thinking, well, if I just really work really hard and get lucky with these leopards, we won't have to use any of this stuff. So I wasn't putting a huge amount of effort into it. And Mike, who was a producer, he said, you're going to have to sort of up your game. Do you know what a presenter does? He's like, watch sort of Chris Packham or Michaela Strachan. I was like, I don't want to do that. So he took the footage, he edited it together and took it to the editor of the Natural History Unit. And he said, look, he's not putting his back into it. And then the editor was like, I just quite like his laid-back style. It's as if he doesn't...
He doesn't care.
And he's like, he doesn't care. And then Mike came back and said, just keep on going. Like, just sort of just act like you don't care. But I think it was sort of... it wasn't a job that I wanted to do, so I did do it in a really kind of like, okay, well, I'm not going to pretend to be someone that I'm not. And I was aware, you know, watching wildlife programs before that, other than David Attenborough, you know, I thought, is that what those people are really like? It's sort of, you know, that sort of over enthusiasm, that kind of outshining kind of the subject. And I thought, okay, I don't want to kind of, the animals are the main attraction. I'm kind of a storyteller. I'm just shining a light on these, and it sort of works. You know, I've made a bit more effort.
I'm sure everybody would agree that is exactly your, as it were, USP, that you do have that laid-back manner. And of course, the other thing is that you do, as we touched on earlier, you do have this extraordinary empathy, apparently, with all sorts of animals. You mentioned the horses, and I was watching the Wild Alaskan Horses program just recently, and you seem to have acquired a kind of understanding without presumably anybody teaching. Is that just experience, just being in those spaces, respecting the animals?
Yeah, I think I've spent a lot of my life just looking at animals and how they behave. And you know, okay, we don't speak the same language, but, you know, horses are incredibly expressive. And, you know, every single animal, you know, anyone that's got a dying dogs are really hyper expressive, but, you know, cats is just, you can understand, you know, what's going on with them just by the sort of, you know, them speaking their language or the kind of the body language. And I, you know, a big part of my job is trying to predict what's going to happen next or what are the potential things that might happen next. And I think you just have to keep your eyes on, whether it's you're sitting with lions or whether you're kind of driving through an environment, you're trying to just pick up on these subtle signs. You have to be really aware, because it might be a vulture dropping out of the sky into sort of a tree line that takes you to a kill that a leopard has made, or it might be a bird fluttering out of the undergrowth that takes you to, you know, a you know, a lion's den. So you just, it's that sort of puzzle. All of this stuff is happening around you, and these sort of animals are out there somewhere. You've just got to kind of find them and try and tell the story.
You said somewhere that animals are much easier to deal with humans because they were more predictable, and you, provided you didn't kind of annoy them, as it were, or get in their way, you could, with some confidence, kind of know what was going to happen.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think with animals, they are easier to predict. There's some, the likes of elephants kind of being hyper-intelligent, and they're kind of a product of their own experiences. So you'll get some elephants that are completely at ease with people, and then you'll get other elephants that have had bad encounters with people that are unpredictable. But even in saying that, once you get to know elephants, you can see that, you know, at a distance. And just in recent years, I've spent... Elephants were one of those animals I was sort of quite wary of, because I didn't understand their kind of their body language. But nowadays, I can see an elephant at, you know, half a mile away, and you kind of know whether that's an approachable elephant. I mean, you're closer. It's just reading those signs, because animals aren't dangerous. That if you are in harm's way around animals, it's something you've done wrong. Something you have done, or something you haven't done. So there's no, you know, animals are not, you know, it's the things that we do that are kind of the most dangerous thing involved.
So this is all going very well, and you know, you also develop, in addition to the presentation skills, you develop this idea of, you know, the family, my family, my family of wolves, my family of elephants, and so on and so forth. And then, and we need to talk about this, because it's an important part of the book, and I feel it's an important part of your story. You then get hit by what Churchill called the black dog. You quote that kind of thing, and you say, you know, it's like the depression is like being hit by a truck. In fact, I think you say hit in the side of the head with a shovel. I think is the phrase you use. Tell us. You don't need to relive it for us. But what I'm interested in really is how, because it happens to so many people, and we're now getting used to the idea that that happens to so many people, and I'm sure many of you in this room have had kind of experiences of that. But I'm more interested in how you dealt with it, and what kind of sort of techniques, if you like, you now have to kind of manage all this.
I used to deal with it by not dealing with it.
Right, like everybody.
Put on a mask and pretend it wasn't, it wasn't happening. And I think I kind of look back to my childhood, and I remember just seeing kids sort of playing about and skipping and being, I was like, what are they so happy about? It's like, pretending to be happy the whole time.
Yeah.
And I thought, that wasn't my reality. I think I always had this little kind of storm cloud following me around. I was just sort of like, I suppose, just anxious, I suppose it was sort of anxiety. And I think this is sort of, I haven't spoken to my mum about this, but I've actually recently been seeing a therapist, and it's quite good sort of talking about these things. And she said, well, you know, you're kind of sort of middle child. So you've got, you know, when I was born, my mum had a 1-year-old, and she had a 2-year-old. So when I come along, my mum said, I think, say this in the book, you know, she said, oh, you thought that the cushion was your mum for the first 2 years in your life, because I just propped you up on the sofa. Yeah. And I think, you know, I thought, God, is it that those first 2 years of life are really formative? So, you know, as a little child, you want to be picked up and held, but you kind of realise that actually that's sort of not, you know, I just don't think I was picked up enough. And I think that sort of probably led to this sort of a lot of this anxiety that I had. And then eventually, you know, and as I said about wearing a mask, I remember like opening up that, you know, I realized, God, and this is before I actually had a kind of breakdown. It was getting to the point, this isn't right. This is kind of, cloud is getting darker and darker and darker. And we were away on a trip, and with three of my colleagues that were friends, and we were in a sort of long car journey in the kind of, near the border with Canada. And I said, I'm depressed. And opening up, I thought, is this a big risk saying to my colleagues that, and they kind of said, no, you're not. You're the last person to get depressed. No, you're always laughing and joking. And I was all right, okay, so maybe I'm not. But then but it always, you know, I had this big crash that was kind of burnout and a kind of just sort of the worst case of depression. And also, I think just being disconnected from, you know, sort of, you know, I think you're working too hard, you get disconnected from your family, your friends, your children. And I think this was just this period, 2 year period where I was, you know, everything was happening at once. And I just went all out to do it all. And it was, I kind of just basically collapsed. I just couldn't, I couldn't get out of bed. And
it is a bit like other kind of addiction type things. You're never kind of cured, are you?
No.
It's always, there's always the possibility. And so you, do you have a sort of a, do you have a routine that you go to if, do you, I don't know.
Well, since then, I just thought, well, I kind of went on a course of antidepressants, and that sort of took away the cloud, but it just left me with this sort of numbness, and I thought, well, I'll come off, and I eventually came off them, and I thought, okay, that's sorted it out, but then it always just would sort of creep back up on me every sort of few years, and I could never really rid myself of it. And the closest, I suppose, the closest I came to ridding myself of it was just, I went all out. It was cold showers, 8 hours sleep, healthy diet, very limited booze, high levels of communication with people, and just being fit and healthy in sort of mind, body, and spirit. And I thought, God, this is never going to come back. But that's quite hard to maintain. I mean, trying to get 8 hours sleep in itself is quite, is really, can be quite difficult.
There you are, ladies. That's Gordon Buchanan's recipe for living. Yeah. I don't want this to turn into the psychiatrist's chair. So let's open it out to the crowd and see what other kind of areas you want to talk about. So we haven't really. I mean, I thought it was important to bring that up because you make.
It's
obviously important to you, kind of thing. But let's hear from the audience, gentleman in the front row there. Yes, sir.
You talk about you being building up an understanding with animals and sensitivity, etc., etc. Having watched some of your TV programs, you're often quite close to very wild, potentially dangerous animals. There must have been times where you must have been genuinely worried in case you'd be attacked, or is that not the case?
Not really the case. I think that sort of there was the commissioner at BBC. The BBC in London, so this is quite at the start of the sort of the Family and Me programmes, he said, oh, your kind of trademark is being inappropriately close to potentially dangerous animals. And I was like, well, it's not inappropriate. Sort of what is appropriate is what that animal is comfortable with. And that is the kind of the key thing, whether it's an elephant or whether it's a wolf or whether it's a mouse, is sort of you have to read their behaviour. And there's some wolves in the world you really can't get within half a mile of. They'll just, and there's other wolves that you can.
Yeah, so there's Norwegian wolves who are kind of, what's the word, acculturated to.
Yeah, they're just kind of habituated. Or those
habituated.
Wolves,
sorry,
the wolves that we filmed in Ellesmere Island, they'd never seen people before, so they hadn't. So, it's all. And when we did the elephant series, just reading their body language, I thought, these elephants I can go really close to, and then you see some big guy that at 100 metres away, I think, I'm going to stay out, I'm just going to get back in the car because he's bad news. So it's about, it's like with people, you know, some people are huggers and some people, we're all different and animals are all different, so you have to kind of try and judge and sort of behave accordingly. And I think certainly for the, to tell those stories, being close to animals, it is more impactful. And if you've got a camera, I think you can tell that story better. Instead of just getting an animal on a hilltop, you're getting a close up of its face, and it goes back to, I suppose, the David Attenborough. He was sort of always, it's like, have David sitting right beside that animal, put him sort of, you know, in the Iruka system.
Famous footage of him and the gorilla back in the day. And in fact, I don't know if you've seen the follow up, you know, the famous polar bear thing in the ice cave and the polar bear's trying to eat you. I don't know if you've seen the follow-up little bit of footage to that, so where, to give you an idea of just how not bothered Gordon appears to be, there is footage of you actually pulling faces at the goes, you know, kind of that's extraordinary.
Not at the polar bear, but actually on camera, because that was a kind of odd situation, because on one hand it was truly terrifying,
yeah,
and you can. But on the other hand, you think, I'll be okay, I think. So you can either sort of choose to lean in either direction. I thought I knew, because it was, you know, it was really scary. I thought, well, just kind of don't give in to that. It's like if you're watching a horror movie, you can help the process by saying, come on, it's just a movie. It's just a movie. So that was, yeah, with the polar bears, it was, you know, so many things could have gone wrong. And I sort of got into trouble with the BBC by publicly talking about the things that, because we'd done the risk assessment and it was supposed to be completely safe, but
yeah, the it was fined.
Yeah.
I can't understand a lot. Anyway, gentlemen here.
If you had a wish tomorrow, would you rather be with your favourite animal or face a crowd at Dumfries House?
Great question.
I get to do both. That's a great thing. I think doing this, sitting in front of a room full of, it would terrify me. I mean, as a child, I was really shy, and I wouldn't, you know, we used to do these PRUs, it was a personal research unit, and you only did one a year, and you had to stand up in front of your class, so it's people that you've grown up with, and talk about your project, and I just, you know, I would dread that all year. I would just have nightmares about it. So I think the presenting side of things is sort of aversion or confrontation therapy. It's like, just do the thing that you feel least comfortable with, and then...
Right, yeah.
I really enjoy events like this, and sort of I do these theatre tours as well, and it's quite... I think just communicating to people, it's just, I really enjoy that. My therapist at point, she goes, you like connection, and I think that's quite... Yeah, she's kind of got me down, as I like connecting with people.
I mean, your manner just today, if I may say so, is very easy, relaxed. We had a very agreeable kind of little meeting beforehand. It was all very laid back, and you don't seem to be at all, kind of feel at all pressurised here now. And your manner on screen is exactly the same as it is in the room, which is nice.
Well, I think if... You know, I was always comfortable with my friends and my family, and I remember thinking, you know, standing in front of a camera for the first time, I thought, if I can't be myself, I'm not going to be anyone else. And I think, we are all better at one thing than anyone else, and that is just being the person that you are. So I think it's sort of, I'd rather not pretend to be anyone else. And I sort of, none of my, friends or family, there's no pretense to any of us. We're all pretty straightforward people, and you know, I think if and you know, growing up with three siblings, you knock it out. You sort of zero tolerance policy
Lady at the back.
Fundamentally, as a filmmaker yourself, is it frustrating when you have to be the presenter with somebody else making the film or filming?
It's only frustrating if I think I'm a better camera person than they are. There's sort of, I don't know, I used to be kind of more of a control freak, I think. I thought I wanted to do it, you know, all myself, and never very good at collaborating with people. And I think that probably goes back to being a kid and not having anyone there to help me. I think my mum was sort of busy, but I didn't ever have anyone like them give you a hand with that. So if my bike broke, you know, that I had to fix it myself. I was sort of, there was no one to, you know, step in for me. And I think I've never been very good at asking people for help. But as time's gone on, I'm like, I've got better at delegating. And I think, okay, if you know, especially the sort of, it's making documentaries is such a collaborative process. And I just, the bit I do is quite small. And depending, some of the projects, I get to do a lot of the filming, but sometimes I don't want to film. Sometimes I'm actually quite happy just sort of doing the chatty bit. Thank you.
The trip you did with the camels in the Gobi Desert, what were they called? Squeaky and...
It's Chewy and Squeak.
Chewy and Squeak. And that was almost, that felt more like a kind of, almost an exploratory, a sort of Benedict Allen type thing. Is that a new area that you're interested in, or is...
Well, we can't, yeah, I think it's sort of, as long as the story is good and it's visually impressive. So these programmes that sort of generally been commissioned for part of the Christmas schedule. The first one that we did was called The Reindeer Family and Me, and it was just me looking for the Northern Lights, and I had a reindeer and a little sleigh, and I kind of thought, well, the reindeer's a character. He's the character. So I kind of just, it was a bit of a buddy movie. It kind of became a bit of a buddy movie. And the director's like, never thought of actually, you know, I just thought reindeer looks cool, but you kind of, you know, and they're quite an impassive creature, but it's sort of making, you're leaning into that talking to this animal and just telling how much you love it. And it's just staring at you, so it's looking right through you. And then we did the snow dogs, and the sort of commissioner at the BBC is like, why now? Because people love dogs and it looks amazing, and I'm going to go off and learn to sort of, so it does, you don't have to. That's the story. It's that you don't have to overthink these things. In the Gobi Desert, I think, you know, camels, I suppose, are one of those creatures that don't really, you know, one of the most recognisable animals on the planet, but they don't really pop
especially
up.
Especially the double hump.
Yeah, they don't pop up in wildlife documentaries. So that was, to have an opportunity to cross a section of the Gobi Desert on camelback was, it was pretty special.
Lady at the back.
Hi, Gordon. First of all, I just want to say thank you, because my son, Harry, came home a few months back and he's like, oh, Mum, we've got to watch this amazing new programme. It's called Big Cat 24/7. Everyone's talking about it at school. And I thought, okay, fantastic. And I happened to have listened to your Desert Island disc before that, but we sat down and we devoured your series. And the only other thing that he's done that with has been David Attenborough. So it was so exciting. And then I told him your story, and I was just thinking about what you said about connection with people. And I wondered, first of all, if you are aware how much you've connected with children as well. Mm. But also, do you think you would, like what Nick did for you, getting my son a job here?
I love it.
You would take the risk of maybe also taking an inexperienced young adult. Mm. I just wonder, you know, now looking back on your story, would you take that same risk?
I've always thought that I kind of would sort of pay it forward. And that, annoyingly, when I, being an assistant was sort of the kind of, if there was a typical route into wildlife filmmaking, that was it. But then these days, it's just the, I haven't had an assistant probably for about 20 years. The BBC, I've only really worked for the BBC for the last 20 years. They'll send somebody out from their team that's already on the payroll. So there's sadly, there's not that opportunity. But I think for any young people wanting to get into the wildlife film industry, get out there and just YouTube, Instagram. So the future is not terrestrial TV. I even mean my future. It's not in the sort of the busiest people these days, the busiest filmmakers. And I was really sniffy about this. And I said, calling yourself a wildlife filmmaker, I've never even heard of you. And you look, they've got like a million followers and probably making £1 million a year. So that sort of is the way.
Right, but the thing that's really, I mean, it's almost banal to social, the thing that's really changed is the tech, you know, digital film. I think on the BBC YouTube, Planet Earth, whatever it's called, you mentioned having 55 cameras. GoPro little tiny units for the camera traps, you know, the availability of all of this stuff, not having to process film, not having to buy. And that's a kind of complete transformation. It's available to, as you say, to anybody.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you can, on your phone, most smartphones, film, edit, publish, find your audience, and to a really high standard. So, yeah, that is the advice that I give myself. It's like, forget TV. because it's just, and it's really exciting because you can tell the stories that you want to tell. And if it's a 30-second story, I suppose that's what TikTok is. It's just little stories. And yeah, I think that's sort of the best traction that anyone's going to get if they want to do that as a job. And as far as sort of connecting with people, it's funny. I think because I haven't really grown up, like I'm still kind of very much like just quite immature, and I remember when, and this is quite a long time ago now, but somebody had said to me, I've been watching you all of my life, and I was like, we're the same age. I was like, no, I'm 20. I don't know how old you are, but I think I've been around. I think now that our kids are sort of 21, 22, I kind of realise that, okay, no, and on Big Cats 24/7, it took me the whole of the first series to realise that I was the oldest person on the shoot, not one of the young guys. I just, someone said, you're the oldest person on the shoot. I went, no, I'm one of that, hang on.
Yeah.
And then somebody was half listening said, how old are you? And I was 52 at the time. Somebody said, how old are you? And I said, 52. And then the person that was half listening said, you're born in 1952. I was like, no. 72. And he said, you're the same age as my mum. And I'm like, what? So, but I think that sort of connection is really important. I think that sort of communication is really important. I sort of look like, whether it's a baby in a pram or whether it's, you know, it's, but kids especially, I think because I haven't really grown up, I find it, it's fun. It's fun to kind of connect with, you know, children. And I was talking to somebody recently, he said, you ever thought of doing kids' TV? And I thought, I would really love to do that.
Be the Johnny Morris.
The David.
Oh, there's a ripple of recognition around the room there. Goodness me. Maybe just one more, but while we're finding anybody, if there is anybody, just what's next, Gordon?
I'm doing another book. Doing another.
Got a taste for it.
Yeah, I have. Yeah. And I thought, well, actually, this has shut everyone up. No one can see. But I really. It's actually events like this that are sort of the most enjoyable part of it. And also, a lot of. You realise that 80,000 words. Isn't that much?
Not really enough.
You've lived a life. It's funny because I actually had looked at the reviews on Amazon. I hadn't bought like.
Yeah, yeah. I read the reviews.
Well, when we finished the book, I thought I am proud of this. I think this is good. But I didn't bother looking at the reviews on Amazon. And it wasn't until maybe 3 months ago. I thought I'm going to read them. And I thought I'm not going to read the good ones. I'll read the kind of the one star. So there was 2 1-star reviews. One of them said the book arrived damaged. I haven't read it yet, but that was so sorry about that. And the second 1-star review was bear in mind this is sort of in the memoirs section. He says all he does is talk about himself.
Well, all I can say is thank you very much for talking about yourself this afternoon. Ladies and gentlemen, Gordon Buchanan.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks to both Gordon Buchanan and Robert Dawson Scott. If you're listening to this online, this was a slightly longer edit than the one that was broadcast on RNIB Connect Radio. And we'll have more from Boswell next week.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.